the show that goes there. This is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it as we are recovering from our weekend and week off for July 4th. Oh, there's a lot of stuff to talk about, but mostly today we'll be covering the past session of the Supreme Court and all the implications it could have going forward. Plus, if we've got time, we'll talk about the mass omess of democracy on the DNC side and try to go through as many as their 20 different people. There's like 27,000 people running for the president right now. Before we get to all of that, some brief introductions are in line. Hi, my name's Shaggy. I am a critical thinker, problem solver, guy just left of normal and sane, but always centered in common sense, and joined today by a guy out of Texas who, swears to God, he's had absolutely zero marijuanas. Please join me in introducing the sugar-laced madman that he is, Drew Landry.
Pew, 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 pew. Hey, man, good to see you. Before we get started, congratulations to the United States Women's National Soccer Team for the fourth FIFA World Cup championship that they won on Sunday. Great for them. Four times.
Yeah. By the way, can we go ahead and say congratulations on the women's soccer team for winning an arbitration case in the fair and equal pay litigation they've had against the league?
That's even better, too, you know. And, you know, it's really time for equality here. So men's national team, you guys got to start winning something. I mean, just win something. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's like a coin toss or tiddlywinks or just, you know, they can't win.
No. They haven't passed the quarterfinals since 1953. Yeah. And yet the women team is paid 30% of their salary and has none of the PR push that their multi-million dollar male franchise is supposed to be. Drew, this is the interesting thing that I found about this soccer game. I know that we're supposed to be talking Supreme Court, but let's talk Supreme Sport.
Do it.
Rapinoe. Okay. This is a woman that has a phenomenal season in soccer, and this is the thing that's got me kind of worried. Now that they've won their arbitration, is it going to set this standard where it's like, okay, so if women in the WNBA, for instance, want to approach the same thing with their league, are they going to have to win four world championships before somebody takes them serious?
That's a good question. I think it's going to be a case-by-case thing. I don't think the WNBA is as popular as the NBA, and that very well could be because of the marketing tools that they're not using for the WNBA or other women's sports that are out there that exist that I don't know about. And I think that has a lot to do with their marketing that's not being used through a lot of these other aspects. We all know about the United States National Women's Team. We know about them because they win, and because the marketing for them has gotten better over the years. I mean, I had to, you know, just before this whole thing started, I heard that they won three, and I had to Google when those years were. I mean, I remember 99 and Brandi Chastain and the iconic photo, and I remembered 2015, but I didn't remember what the time before that. And that was, you know, 1991. I had to realize that there was a team that won it even before then. So that speaks volumes to the fact that the women's sports, even though Title IX is there for that equality, hasn't been given the same type of volume and marketing there. So this is a very good – this case that they won in arbitration is going to be a tremendous step forward for all of them. And if I don't know if there's a women's Olympic – a basketball team, there possibly could be, and I don't know about it. And that, again, speaks volumes to the fact that they're not marketing it out. But if there is, what?
Just keep going, Drew. I'm just like, okay. You don't know about the women's U.S. basketball?
I think that just speaks to it. And if they win gold medal after gold medal after gold medal, So I think you're probably right about that at the beginning of it. The women's soccer team and the women's national basketball team. It's going to take some time for us to recognize it and to attend their games and to really get involved in it. And that's just my take.
Now, this is something that I've got to add in because this is kind of a funny story. During the time that the U.S. team was playing against France, a lot of hard right wingers were in the audience. And of course, they were chanting anti-LGBTQ kind of stuff and yelling F Rapinoe and things like that. Now, that iconic picture that you're talking about in 1999 is kind of not as epic as the iconic picture of Rapinoe taken in 2019 in France with her arms outstretched. And the reason that picture is so iconic is because they're literally chanting the most hateful thing to her, and she just scored.
Yep. Yep. That's just amazing, the fact. And what I don't like about it is that if that was one of the male players, if that was a male soccer player doing all the chanting and doing all the little bravado, they'd have no problem with that. But since it's a woman doing it, it suddenly makes a bit of a headline, and now it's, you're arrogant and whatever else. I mean, the whole sexism in is just apparent no matter where we are. Mm. That was a little chime in there for your point, I think, that you're wanting to make. But
yeah, something about a book called The Beauty Myth and how there's an unfair standards against one gender than there is the other, and there's this whole hyperbole around it. But the other thing that I was going to bring up about this, and I said, one, the iconic picture of her doing the, hey, I just scored on you, bring it. The second part happened on Sunday. After the victory, Fox News decided to go live from a bar in, I believe, Lyon, France. Now, it just so happened that this bar in France was watching the World Cup, and they were they saw the women's match happen, and Fox News was just like, hey, America won, and they're like, let's go live around the world to see the reaction. They went live to a bar in France. Drew, did you see how that turned out for them?
I did, yeah. It was kind of embarrassing for Fox News. Like the people in, I guess, the attendees in the bar started to yell F Trump. And not just yell it, they were chanting it so that everybody could understand what they were saying. Mm-hmm. There was no ambiguity. You knew immediately what they were saying. And so the reporter there who's being live says a couple times, well, we thought about going outside, but no, we came in here. And
nobody cares, dude. Nobody cares. It was so surreal to watch because normally Fox News would be like, okay, cut away. But they had like no warning. It started at like 3 seconds into the live feed and only got louder as the bit went on. So I'm going to ask a very simple question. Drew, do you think that France people are a fan of our current situation in the United States?
I don't think they're a big fan of our president. No, I don't think there's a lot of European leaders who are.
No.
Except for Putin. I think Putin likes him a lot. But Macron and the other French leaders and other European people are just like, you know what, you guys can have him. We're going, we don't want him.
Well, let's not forget that over the weekend, too, we discovered that the UK UK ambassador wrote some pretty interesting words describing our current president. Some of those words are inept.
Yeah. Yep. And Trump comes out, the Trump administration is all about, you shouldn't say that. And the British government just said, hey, whatever, deal with it. They actually defended this ambassador to say these things. So, hey, right back at you.
right? It's like, you called our queen rude.
Yes.
You know, it was like, at that point, the British people, I mean, could not have collectively harumped loud enough. said harumping would have displaced the Earth's current atmosphere.
Yeah.
Leaving nothing behind.
It really would have. Yeah.
Nothing behind but a barren wasteland of disappointment in Donald Trump presidency. But this is
no
the thing,
question.
Drew. A lot of people talk a lot of stuff about the president, and the president this and the president that. And when we were doing parades this weekend, of course, a lot of people wanted to bring up the president's name at a local parade by having flags and yelling and screaming at people. But not a lot of people actually talk about the machinations of the rest of the government that's been happening as of late. And one of the things that just ended its session is the Supreme Court. Now, with this session now being in the can, we can look back at some of the stuff they've done over the year. And I want to begin with one of the most controversial cases that they heard. Drew, could you please walk us through the Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina gerrymandering debacle and how it ended up in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, sure. So what happens here? Let me just try to dissect this and not bore everybody. Every 10 years, states will redraw the maps for the legislature and for the U.S. House of Representatives and whatever type of other maps that states have. And what they'll do there is, more often than not, it's the lawmakers of the state who will redraw the maps. Now, they're not getting out slide rules and actually doing, carving out maps like they did, so many years ago. You know, they're using software that are contracted out through the state, and so they're able to redraw these maps with what one federal judge said with surgical precision. And so the way that a map looks is not by accident. So what I'm getting at here is that the majority party will redraw the maps to benefit that party. And so there's a term for this, and it's called gerrymandering, named after Elbridge Gerry, founding father, signer of the Declaration, yada, yada, yada. Okay? This has been going on since 1812, and he's the father of gerrymandering. Now that we've got that out of the way, we bring this into these particular cases.
But
yes.
I just want to bring this up.
Sure.
He's not the father of gerrymandering so much as he's the father of whistleblowing on what gerrymandering is, and then they kind of just straddled the whole thing with his name.
Well, yeah, in a sense, but his name is forever etched into the whole aspect of, you could say, cheating, but for better, for worse. But anyway,
I might as well have just called it Hamiltoning.
That's exactly what they should. That would be a much better name. So, that's another rant I got to say for another time.
Okay.
Anyway, so we get into North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and all these other states that have this long history of screwing over other parties. So they're sued over this, what's called partisan gerrymandering, where one party will particularly use their influence of redrawing the maps to put the other party at a tremendous disadvantage. Meaning the other party, being the Democratic Party, who are in minorities in the state legislature, can't really get a gain or any type of foothold because of the redrawing of the maps from the previous census. So they're upset about this because even though there might be more of them, they're actually in smaller districts and their influence is very small. So they can't win a whole lot of elections because of this gerrymandering, because of this rigging. All right?
All right.
So they sue over what's called partisan gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. All right? Now, this was done in the 1980s, and the Supreme Court said, we're not touching it. So they thought maybe they'll bring it back and they can, have a sense this is actually hurting the Democratic experience that we that we have in this country, and the fact that there's a harm done to people's vote, that it's not one person, one vote, that people's votes are actually being harmed by this gerrymandering. Well, what was done here is that the Supreme Court, yet again, in a 5-4 decision, said, this is a political question, we're not answering it, and so it's still going to be alive. So what they said there is, well, no, this isn't really much of a harm. States get to draw whatever maps that they want. You don't like the maps that they don't want, don't vote for these people. So very, very short term here, gerrymandering is going to be alive and well come 2021. And that makes the election of 2020 even more important than just electing the president. This is why you have to pay attention to who's running for state legislature, state senate, because they're going to be the ones drawing those maps. And I think if you're on the Democratic side, you've always been shy and trying to, you know, take the higher ground for the past maybe, you know, 10, 15 years or so, trying to say, well, we don't want to gerrymander. Well, I think you got to come out and say, yeah, we win. We're going to screw over the Republicans, because the Republicans have been screwing over the Democrats over this for some time. So they just got to take off the gloves and not be so caretaking about it. So,
you know, I just, before you go any further, the thing that I want to bring up is, like, a lot of people don't understand exactly how this ended up in the Supreme Court. And I wanted to bring up the very little known equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment. Drew, sure. Why is it that when this decision came out, they actually referenced not only the First Amendment, saying, hey, gerrymandering violates our First Amendment right, but the one that really got me was it also violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Elections Clause, so on and so forth. But what is the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and how does gerrymandering actually violate that clause?
Yeah, that's a great question. The 14th Amendment, having this, what the Equal Protection Clause, saying that no state shall inhibit anyone's equal protection without due process. Okay, so this is stating that the Bill of Rights and all the other aspects get brought down to the states. It's the inclusionary doctrine. So what we're talking about here is the 14th Amendment has this aspect of the equal protection, meaning everybody, that no state shall violate the equal protection of everybody there. All right, so everyone's going to get the same treatment under the law. That's what this is talking about. All right. Now, you may say, well, what does voting have to do with that? If everyone gets to vote, what's the big deal about gerrymandering? Okay, fair question. What this comes down to is, if someone draws a map and it has maybe a 1,000 constituents in this district, and someone draws another map and it has 100,000 constituents in that district, there's what's called malapportionment. Meaning the influence that one person has in one district will be stronger or less than the others of in another district. So what I'm getting at here is that your vote will count more or less depending on the size of the district. So if you are considerably less people, or you are of, you know, if the Democrats are saying there's less of us and we are, that's a strategic move to put us in that district. Like, you purposely made less Democrats in this district. You have put us in an area where our influence is not equal than what it would be to those in another district. That's a violation of equal protection. That violates what's called one person, one vote. Mm. That's the argument. That's the connection there.
But the thing
and,
is, this,
the Supreme Court disagreed.
Okay, well, that's what I kind of wanted to bring up, because the thing with that all there is people don't understand about voter disproportionality. And when we mention voter disproportionality, we have to talk about representation. Now, in these gerrymandering cases, specifically, let's go to the one in North Carolina. North Carolina's districting lines were drawn with a computer in such a way that Black Americans in those communities in that state could never, ever statistically or numerically have an influence on the machinations of North Carolina's House of Assembly. Now, that to me does not seem like an equal protection. But instead, what they're saying in this kind of opinion is let me get this straight, is no, the fact that both of these parties have a chance to vote, that's what is constitutionally considered protection. But the representation inherent as to what their vote counts, that is something that we're not ruling on. Did I misunderstand this case?
No, that's exactly what essentially what they're saying here is that the fact that it's disproportionate in one way has nothing to do with courts, has everything to do with you voting. So if you don't like it, and let's just be honest here, this is a very simplistic approach. If you don't like it, don't vote for them. Okay, that makes sense, but there's so few of us, our influence is going to be so incredibly small that it's not going to matter. So, but that's how the court feels about it. And I just want to, if I can just take just a small second, just a small moment here to point to all the people who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because you didn't like her emails or any of that stuff. That person, that Brett Kavanaugh, could easily be Merrick Garland or some other person who would have voted in favor of saying, yes, this is a problem and gerrymandering should be illegal. But no, you were fine. You were fine with something else. So, sorry, I that's something that's been weighing on me. I just had to get that off my chest.
Gosh, Drew, it sounds like you're almost angry enough to run for office again.
But let's not get too crazy.
Yeah, the thing is that this is actually kind of a crazy decision because Sotomayor basically came out and said, hey, you know what? As one of the people on the dissenting view, can I just say that we have dropped the ball here? This is exactly the kind of political malfeasance that we are supposed to step in and stop. And the fact that you're kicking it back down, this is going to damage American democracy as we know it. In that dissenting opinion, a lot of people have said, oh, this is sour grapes. But Drew, there is a lot of political precedents being set by this case, isn't there?
Absolutely. This has been, done in the Court of Appeals. This has been, this has been done before. I mean, other states have taken the lead in trying to get rid of gerrymandering. I mean, even Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was a Republican in California, he fought against gerrymandering. Who would have thought that he would do something like that? Okay, Iowa has done this. Arizona has done something like this. So you know, trying to get rid of this gerrymandering is really going to take some bold leadership. And if the Supreme Court says, look, this is just going to be a state thing, it's going to have to be this, landmark aspect that has gone out of its way to bring it back up to the Supreme Court. I don't think this is going to be done and dead and we're never going to talk about partisan gerrymandering in the Supreme Court again, because I have a feeling that we will, but it's going to take some sort of movement to get it back and to make the right decision.
Yeah, because
this
is the thing. This is what I see happening here is that they've kicked it back down, okay? And this is where, and we'll probably do this after the break because we're coming up on it, but
sure.
No, we can squeeze this in now because, look, this is the thing. They did not strike down any of the gerrymandering. They just basically kicked it back down to lower courts. And this has happened in two kind of big landmark cases where the judge didn't say, no, this is wrong or this is right. They just said, we don't want to weigh in on it. So whatever the lower courts say goes. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. What happens in state after state after state after state where it goes up through their state Supreme Court? Time and time and time again, without a federal oversight answer, Drew.
Yeah, they're just going to decide whatever they think is good for them. And in Texas, I can tell you, we elect all of our judges, and all of them have an R next to their name. So I don't really see that, if there is a gerrymandering case that goes up to the Texas Supreme Court that does not benefit the Republicans, it'll probably be thrown back. But if it does benefit the Republicans, they'll let it stay.
Yeah, so only in certain states can somebody actually find voter protection in equal form, as supposedly guaranteed to us by the 14th Amendment. So it seems weird that that's one of the things that they kicked back. It's like, hey, you know what? When we talk about the equal, you know, when we talk about the 14th Amendment, period, it is supposed to be basically everybody is on a level playing field.
That's right.
And as such, what is it called? Jurisprudence would say that gerrymandering takes people off of that level playing field. But instead, in their, you know, main comments, Justice Clarence Thomas basically said, none our business. We going to back out of this. Here's the thing, and we've got like a minute left here. Drew, is this the Supreme Court's business like Clarence Thomas says it's not? Or is this going to lead to a nightmare situation where the states are going to eventually have so many cases, it's going to have to go back to the Supreme Court again?
Well, all due respect to Judge Clarence Thomas, he's wrong. This is the Supreme Court's business. Sotomayor is correct, because there are great threats to small d democratic values when it comes to just screwing over one party over the other because you don't like the way that they vote. This is not founders' intent. This is a perversion of redistricting, and it's just flat out wrong. So let's just get this incredibly clear here. The court had a great opportunity, and they got scared and they punted because they didn't want to take bold leadership.
No, and when we get back, we'll talk about what that lack of bold leadership could mean going forward into 2020. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Get informed. This is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show. Welcome back to it. Of course, if you missed any part of it, where were you? We missed you so much. So go back and check in with all the fun that I had in the first segment. Well, either through Spotify, through iHeartMedia, iTunes, what have you. Just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. A guy that you can find who will possibly very soon hanging out in bars talking about, I remember when people knew something about the Supreme Court. Today's correspondent who's helping me run through the big season this year in the SC, please welcome Drew Landry.
Hey, I'm back.
Yes, sir. You know, the funny thing is like this season on the SC does kind of sound like a WB show from the 1990s.
It really does. I'm ready for a Paula Cole song to come through.
Oh, God, not Paula Cole.
I don't want to wait.
Well, I want to kind of talk about one of the weird little landmark decisions that recently came out of the Supreme Court that I don't think a lot of people are going to be really up on. And that has to do with Tennessee Wine and Spirits versus Thomas. Now, Drew, how much do you know about whiskey?
It tastes really good in soda.
What about
and
wine?
I like Jack. So
okay. Well, here's something that you probably didn't know. Actually, you probably did know, but you never take any moment to think about it. Have you ever thought, I would really like to order online a set of spirits from a Tennessee distillery and have it delivered to my door in Texas?
No.
There's a reason why you've never had that thought, and that has to do with how state by state, ever since the repeal of Prohibition, have kind of been on this sliding scale of they could decide how much or how little alcohol people want. Let's just say that this is the male version of Roe v. Wade, because it has to do with how much rights people can have depending on how conservative their areas are. But there's a problem. You see, when these laws, and here's the fun thing, when these laws actually start to stymie or stigmatize certain businesses from moving across state lines, this violates the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause. And as such, there was a case of a family moving from Michigan to Tennessee, and they could not buy a distillery because they didn't meet the mandatory minimum residency law. Now, Tennessee decided a long time ago that if you want to own a distillery or anything like that, you have to be an in-state resident for at least 10 years. And if you want to be an owner-operator of said facility, you had to, and that's not owning it, just operating the business, you had to have an in-state residency of 2 years. The Supreme Court actually struck down the Tennessee law, saying that this made it impossible for commerce to come across state lines and be assured equal protection. But Drew, guess what else it might possibly have done?
You're going to tell me what?
It might have established the first ever national alcoholic market in the United States. You see, with this decision, and states cannot discriminate against other states' alcoholic properties, all of the craft beers that are usually kept in their individual state, thanks to these antiquated draconian laws, will now be available to cross state lines. Little known fact, there's actually a lot of states that have laws where you can't legally drive across the state line, buy alcohol, and drive back to your house. These laws are very seldom enforced, but they've been there since the onset of post-prohibition America. This decision could mean that distilleries, local breweries, and craft beers, wines, and alcohols could find themselves available online to a national market for the first time ever. And Drew, the potential windfall of this Supreme Court decision is rated in the billions of dollars gained for the alcohol industry.
That's great. I mean, that's how I'm gonna feel about that. I mean, I can understand if there's extra added cost to stuff, and I can get that. But I'm just like, you know what? That's more customers for you. I mean, you're able to take and compete with other craft breweries in other states. Good for you. Good for you. Well, so more power to you.
The thing is that this also gets rid of that whole stigma between businesses moving from one state to the other, whereas an alcoholic business had a lot of draconian regulations to move from one state to the other. Now, with this Supreme Court decision, that those things could be struck down across the board. And with that decision, that could also establish the first national alcoholic market in the United States. Woohoo! Alcohol.
I mean, I'll be waiting for you to order your favorite craft beer out of North Carolina to have it delivered to you in Maui. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, you mean the Carolina Blonde?
Yes.
Yeah, it is a small craft beer in North Carolina. I will go ahead and say that. However, as a well-traveled man, let me tell you, there is nothing like the Oregonic beers of the great Northwest. Some have been infused. Those probably won't cross state lines. The thing is like a lot of people always think that when the Supreme Court sits down to do judgments, that their judgments are always going to be about very big social and progressive things, and they're going to have instant ramifications. But see, with this decision, this is one of those decisions that the Supreme Court makes that seems very small and, hey, we're laughing about it, but at the same time could increase our national GDP and, in fact, revitalize an entire industry on a scale that it has not been able to achieve since before Prohibition. That's kind of a big deal thing that the Supreme Court does all the time, but we barely notice it. Am I right, Drew?
Oh, you're exactly right. You know, we also, one that got like maybe one day of fame and people forgot about it was the trademark of an explicit logo, mm-hmm. or you know, and so they said, yeah, you can have that, even though it's an explicit form. That's perfectly fine. You can make that up. That's perfectly fine. So kind of an interesting aspect as to how that works out. Just another particular example as to what you were talking about. It wasn't some big sweeping, social movement that they were allowing to go on or stopping, or wasn't some, any other type of thing that we talked about here with a great length, but it was a small thing and got some headlines and people go, yeah, okay, I can make my own logo and emblem and trademark it, and it can be as obscene as I want it to be. Cool. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the Supreme Court's job too.
Yeah. And, as it stands, the logo for this show will now change over to the dork. And if you don't know what an actual dork is, we see a lot of them in mating season during the migration of the whales. Look it up in a dictionary, kids. You will be surprised what you have been calling your friends this entire time.
That's why I never thought it was a bad thing that I got called one, so I'm down with it.
Yeah, you know, dork. It's like, oh, you've heard the rumors. But here's the thing. As long as we're talking about cases that the Supreme Court does, that we're going to have ramifications down the line that a lot of people don't understand. Before we go into the let's not talk about cases that the Supreme Court did not approach this year, I want to talk about Mitchell versus Wisconsin. Drew, how much do you know about that one?
Well, I didn't really memorize the names of the cases, but if you can tell me what the whole thing is about, I'll be able to talk about it.
Okay, check this out. There was a man named Mitchell. He was, and I'm going to say this very, very loudly, a bad man. Okay? Now, he was caught a while ago doing bad things with child pornography. As such, he went to jail. Big surprise. Upon getting out of jail, he once again goes and finds massive amounts of child pornography, therefore violating the conditions of his probation. However, in the judgment in the state of Wisconsin against the defendant Mitchell, they actually tacked on more of a sentence versus his original sentence, which, did not know this, violates something in the Eighth Amendment. And Drew, Mitchell, who is once again a very bad, bad, bad man, actually had a good decision for him in the Supreme Court, whereas they said, look, even if you got caught doing something that violated your probation, the court did not have the right to go back and add more of a sentence to you than the original sentence could deem necessary, especially given that there you have a minimum and maximum sentencing for your case. This could have ramifications on bad people for a while, couldn't it, Drew?
Yeah, it could. And even some of the other type of decisions that people want to make on bad people. I mean, you're exactly right, Shaggy. This is not a good man. This is not a good person who had any type of good intentions for anything. And he definitely deserves to be in jail, locked away for a very long time. But for the court to be active and to be excited about adding more punishment is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. I mean, that's just clear, violation of cruel and unusual punishment. That's just too excessive. And the court made the right decision on this. As bad as it is to say for someone who is terrible, I mean, we have to keep repeating this because this is actually a fair decision on a terrible, awful, no good person. But, you know, you wouldn't want that done to anybody else if it was some small crime, whether it was, if you got ticketed twice and then suddenly they added on more penalties because you got, doing some speeding ticket or whatever it was, and a judge just wanted to arbitrarily do more punishments to you. This is going to have that kind of seeping down, that effect to say, you know what, you can't have that. I mean, it's just the punishment is what's there, and you can't add more to it. That's incredibly fair, and so that's, for this terrible, awful person, and deserves the punishment that he got. The Constitution is rather clear that, you know, adding more to it would be excessive and cruel and unusual. So, as much as we want to add more pain to a terrible person as he is, you know, that's just not going to be possible.
I know. This is one of those stories where it's like you find out the hero was the villain all along. But look, and the thing that you brought up, though, in Mitchell versus Wisconsin, that is exactly the kind of repercussions this little case could have, despite being used for, once again, an inherently evil person who is, by no stretch of the imagination, ever redeemable in the eyes of humanity. This guy actually is setting a nice precedent for the rest of us. And the reason why is because in rural districts across the United States, time and time and time again, minority communities have found themselves under a heavy sentence that just keeps getting added up, especially in states with for-profit prison systems. So that's one of the craziest things. Thanks to a child pornographer, we might actually have a little bit more justice in the justice system towards minority.
Yeah, it's odd to think someone like that, but, and again, I mean, we've really said a lot here, but it can't be said enough. It's rather awkward to thank this person for this because, you know, he's just not a good person, but it's, you know, this is the right decision, and this is something that we can point to and say, you can't add on more punishments to somebody just because they look different or they are different or whatever the case may be, have a different last name, speak a different language. That's not what our Constitution does. And it's good that this case, again, in the most awkward situations and the unique ways that it was brought up, allows that to stop any type of, you know, Barney Fife in Kansas or in Texas or any other place.
It does seem like there is the precedence here for this law to actually start to be applied almost retroactively to cases that have happened even over the course of the last couple of years, whereas people inside of the system, all of a sudden, some minor infraction adds 4 to 5 years to something that was supposed to start out as a petty crime only carrying a 3 to 5 year sentencing maximum. So with all of this said, it's going to still be very hard to think in the future, wow, thank you, child molesters, for making sure that the judiciary in the United States is a little bit more fair.
You're right. And I know that if, you know, there's just one other case that I like to mention up here because it kind of plays into this notion of you know, leading into things. We often like to talk about the president, and we should because he's the president, and sometimes he likes to remind us that he's the president. But there was a case dealing with the state of New York and federal crimes, and what the Supreme Court said is that you can be tried for a federal crime, and then the state can come after you for it too, meaning, if a state tries you and the federal government tries you, that's not double jeopardy. So bear that in mind. This can be used as repercussions for the state of New York to go after the Trump family and the president on any type of the collusion, cover up, any of these types of things that may not be done with at the federal level. And so the Supreme Court set the standard here that's not double jeopardy. You might say, well, I've heard that term before on a game show. Well, it showed up in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It says you will not be tried for the same case twice, for the same crime twice. Well, truth be told, that's as according to the Supreme Court, that is only for federal. And if you do something in the state, that doesn't violate that. Mm-hmm. So, kind of an interesting turn here. I don't know if any of the other lawmakers who may not like that will take action in their next session to say or be more clear with that language, or if Congress will do something with that. But it seems kind of interesting that it's coming around this kind of time when we're talking about presidential elections, and we mention this, and it's all like, you know, it's just some sort of a perfect storm.
Yeah, because let's just go ahead and say, when it comes to things that are perfect and stormy, well, Donald Trump doesn't know how to handle either one of those. So you would figure that the Supreme Court would be able to get in and make some sense out of life as we know it. But this is the thing. A lot of people have said, but, Shaggy, when it comes to this Supreme Court, we know that Trump kind of stacked the deck with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. We know that he did that for the reason of keeping himself in power indefinitely. Ooh, let me whip out the tinfoil hat and go to my whiteboard to show you what's happening. Usually, before they get down that path, I'm saying, hey, but wait a minute. The Supreme Court actually did two things by not doing two things this year that are pretty heavy. Now, yeah. One of them, before we get to the second one that they did just recently to the president, let's talk about the first one they did. This is the Supreme Court not punting, but deciding, hey, what we've done before in the past was kind of good enough, so we're not going to go back and change anything. Of course, I'm talking about Alabama and other states trying to bring forth a class action lawsuit to overturn Roe v. Wade this year. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said, not hearing it. Drew, that had a lot of significance, didn't it?
Absolutely. That was, you know, them saying, okay, not this time around. And that is really sour to all the ones who are really hoping, you know, to retry Roe, to really do what they can to really just overturn it. And that's what they're wanting to do. And those are cases that they can bring that up. But truth be told, you know, when Pat Robertson goes on public waves and says that the Alabama law is not the right one to challenge, you know, we're not going to win that case. You know that something is, you know, screwy going on in the world whenever he says something like that. But back to what your point is absolutely right. You know, this was something that they were really hoping for, that the court would hear this case and then essentially retry Roe. Whereas they said, no, we're not going to hear that case this time. That doesn't mean it can't be heard next year or the year after or the year after that. I mean, this can take up some time, but for right now, no, they told you, you know, they gave you the no.
No. And see, that's got kind of big implications because the people that are running for president on the DNC side have all said, ha 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 ha, the courts will fail you, women. So what we need to do is actually get this into the legislative phase and make national laws about it. But Drew, this has been going on since 1974. We've been trying to get the Equal Rights Amendment since 1972. Neither one of those seem to be working out well. What makes the DNC now think is the time for the legislator to take up this question, even after the Supreme Court said we're not going to?
Well, I think it's the fact that this is a trying to win seats and you know we're coming up to an election here trying to really galvanize the base of the Democratic Party with some of these particular candidates who are really trying to woo them and say, hey, come on to my coattails. We can make this a big movement and really mobilize women to come out to vote in favor of whatever candidate that's going to be the president and the candidate for president. And then all the other Democrats who are on there who will talk about this issue as openly and bravely as they can so that then they can get a majority in these legislatures. And then they can pass some of these laws that will not be so anti-women. And I think that might be part of their goal. Also, if they can get a majority in Congress, they can make this a federal issue, keep the House, take over the Senate, kick out Mitch McConnell, and, as the majority leader, not just that, but also out of the Senate, and then say, hey, you know what? We have a Democratic majority in both House and Senate in Congress. We have a Democratic president. How about we do something on the women's right to choose from a legislative perspective here and really make this a national issue. Therefore, you don't really have to worry so much about Alabama and Missouri and Ohio and all these other state heartbeat bills. And now we're back to a conversation about federal government and states. I hope that's a very long-winded answer. I hope that got to some of your point.
Yeah, because see, the next one that you're going to have to give us a long-winded answer on is why did the Supreme Court basically tell Donald Trump's administration, you know what? We're not going to allow this census question. we're not going to not allow it, but we're not going to not allow. It was a very confusing kind of thing, according to all of the talking heads. But essentially, the Supreme Court said, and I am not making this up, break out your thesaurus. Chief Justice John Roberts finds 14 different instances to lie to, well, to call Donald Trump an inept liar. The question seems contrived. I mean, go on. You read it, right?
I don't remember all of the synonyms to it, but I will say this. Just to give you a Reader's Digest version of this particular decision, what they're saying here is, look, you got to tell us why it needs to be on here. That's really what it comes down to. We're not saying that citizenship questions can't be put on a census, nor are we saying that you cannot put them on there. All that we're saying is you haven't told us why you want to put it on here. So you got to tell us a constitutional reason why you want to do this. And so by them saying essentially, you know, tell us why, which can be viewed as you can't ask the question. The census is being printed right now. I mean, this is from the executive agencies. They're making these questionnaires as we are talking throughout this entire time, because they're going to mail them out come January 2020, and then you got to mail them back in. So I don't know what kind of timeline that the president keeps saying, oh yeah, we're going to add that question in there. Not quite sure what timeline that he's working on, because if he does it in the fall and then they bring them their reason why they want to put it on the census, what time will the Commerce Department have to print a whole new set of millions of pamphlets and questionnaires and then mail them out on time? It's just not going to work. So there's a timing issue here, and I don't think that the Trump administration is going to have a really good enough reason to convince the Supreme Court that we need, here's a constitutional reason that we need to have a citizenship question. I don't think they're going to have it.
No, because, I mean, unfortunately, the only way that they could approve that question is if they say, because Donald Trump was on television yesterday saying things like, it happened back in the 1950s. We had a question on there about citizenship. It was important then. It's important now. But here's the thing. It wasn't important then, and that's actually why it came off. In the 1950s, we knew that was a stupid thing to ask. Drew, we've got like a minute and a half here. Why does he think it's a good thing to ask in 2019?
Well, he's on this whole bent that 3 million people in California illegally voted and didn't vote for him. And so this all comes back to the fact he didn't win the popular vote in 2016. And it comes down to the fact that he's having this hard stance on immigration. And he wants people who check no on a question like that. And when they send it back in, to have ICE come to their house and round them up and get them out. That's what this comes down to. He just doesn't want those types of people in this country. And he doesn't think that, you know, that they have any place here or any of those things. And so that's his position on it. That's why he wants the question. And there's really anything else clear than just simply that.
Yep. And that's how we end the show, ladies and gentlemen. Till next time. Love you, mean it. Get in, bye.